Ben Rothenberg is the leading tennis journalist on the planet right now. He's a contributor for CNN, the New York Times, the BBC, just to name a few, Jared. And he was at the forefront of what's going to be known as one of the biggest sports stories of the last, 50 years?
Yep. You can name a number.
It couldn't be far off that.
You name a number, and it's going to qualify without question. Ben Rothenberg joins us from down at Melbourne Park. Another interesting day, Ben, but firstly, welcome back to Melbourne.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Greg. Good back here.
It's been an interesting time, totally different to every other time you've been here when it's just a total celebration of tennis. This is almost a bit like what we have 28 weeks of the year in a football season where there's a calamity almost each and every week for Tennis Australia. This has been almost their annus horribilis in many respects.
No, absolutely. Luckily, I do think they've managed to leave most of their problems at the door on day one of the slam, getting the Djokovic thing sorted out and having him on a plane out of the country the day before the tournament started, I think has led to a relatively cleaner break than if he, actually been in the draw and it had been a whole spectacle and circus about him playing. So in some ways, I think the damage was kind of minimized, but absolutely, it was everyone started the tournament with much more of a hangover than you usually have the first day of this slam year, which is usually sort of a back to school kind of happy time.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with you. I'm just interested in if you could expand a little bit more on what you thought would have been the case had Djokovic had stayed. I think the biggest winner out of the ultimate ruling by the federal court was Tennis Australia, because personally, I think it would have been an ongoing debacle the whole way through.
Yeah, I think it would have been a real security concern, honestly. I mean, there were a lot of heated, passions. This is a very fractious issue, the whole anti-vax situation and Novak as a person can be very polarizing. Tons of strong support in the Serbian community in Melbourne, which is pretty robust, but also obviously a lot of antipathy towards him in the wider Australian population, as the polls showed. It just would have been a really divisive, really heated atmosphere that could potentially have been fairly volatile in some ways. So I think it's probably just for pure, health and safety concerns, probably not a bad thing to avoid that situation, because it could have boiled over and, potentially seven times if he kept marching on the tournament.
Ben, what do you think has been the reaction or the overall feeling in the US? I mean, depending on what reports you believe, French Open is kind of tossing and turning over whether they actually let him in. And New York, I think, along with LA, might be the only two states with mandates for vaccines, as we have here in Melbourne. So what's the atmosphere going to be like for him at Flushing Meadows?
Well, yeah, it depends on if he can get in. I think from what I understand of the border requirements for just immigration into the country, they are requiring vaccination now. And who knows what kind of other exemptions he might try to apply for in the future. But that's going to be a very uphill road for him trying to get around those rules and always trying to find side doors into countries as the world gets increasingly vaccinated. And vaccines have been available, worldwide long enough now that I think it's fair for countries to mandate them, which it wasn't, 6 months ago when these things were still less readily available for people. So, in the U.S., I think he's been a punchline. I mean, literally, they did a sketch about him or a brief skit about him on Saturday Night Live this weekend in the U.S., just making fun of Djokovic. And so that's kind of where it is. I mean, he's just seen as sort of a joke and someone who's easy for the vast majority of the population who is vaccinated and supportive of the concept of vaccines to pretty easily, mock the same way as in other sports, in the NFL, Aaron Rodgers, who's the quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, who's eliminated from the NFL playoffs this weekend. And that was also met with a lot of sort of glee and, schadenfreude from folks. So not dissimilar to Djokovic, really.
I've heard a number of commentators say what more could Tennis Australia have done trying to get the best tennis player itself, but I think they make those comments without actually understanding what this community has been through over the last 2 years.
Yeah, I don't understand the calculation that they made at all, or I think it's completely wrong. I think this tournament would have completely survived and thrived without Djokovic if he just hadn't ever, gotten on a plane here. I think it's a Grand Slam that endures. It's been around for, there's posters around the grounds this year celebrating 100 years of Australian Open women's competition. I mean, this is a really enduring event, and there's plenty of pullouts and absences that happen at various times, and it's much bigger than any one person. And so I think the real mistake they made was trying to bend the rules to accommodate Djokovic and to build this whole exemption process really just for him. I mean, it was only he and this one other Czech player who kind of wandered onto Djokovic's path somewhat unintendedly, who was who this was set up for. And I think Craig Kiely really had, I probably just as, you know, somewhat of a theoretically neutral arbiter as a tournament director. I know obviously he's not, but you know, to make the rules, enforce the rules, and then kind of be agnostic a bit on who shows up or doesn't, you know, because the rules were fair. And I think it's, and there was certainly a lot of resentment in the player community that Djokovic was seen as finding a way to get around the rules that everyone else had been following.
So that was my follow-up question. How deep was that resentment, and how do you think it would have played out had he been here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he was, I mean, he was here at the tournament site practicing for a few days, and I heard from a couple people that it was just awkward having him, you know, walk into the room and having been the subject of conversation and controversy and just distraction for everybody. Yeah, and then obviously on site it would have been, he would have been the whole story. I mean, this was a huge, huge, massive story around the world. It just hit this, you know, cross section of lots of different things in sports and society and health and the pandemic and politics and immigration and all sorts of stuff. And that sort of heat would have, I think, sustained and really distracted from the tennis. And, you know, and for some people might have benefited from that. Like, let's say someone like an Ash Barty, you know, who might have been getting a lot of hype and pressure for coming up into her Australian Open, was able to arrive fairly under the radar, you know, because Djokovic took all the attention in the spotlight for the build-up time. So maybe there's some unintended benefits for some other players who might not have minded, you know, someone else overshadowing them or giving them a bit of cover.
Ben, speaking of Aussies, I'm interested in your thoughts on Nick Kyrgios. I mean, we all know that, you know, his talent is great, but in between the years, it hasn't been as great for him. I thought the thing that went underrated at his press conference late that night against Medvedev was that he wouldn't confirm whether this year would be his last year on tour or not. I mean, is this guy going to end up retiring before he's 30, having only made a couple of Grand Slam quarterfinals?
Yeah, I was actually the one who asked him that question because I had been sort of, he dropped hints about that before last summer as well. And he, you know, it's tough to know with Nick. And, you know, sometimes I think he just says things like that to get attention, honestly. But also I do think that he's, you know, a bit conflicted and just not really sure what he wants. But also I don't know what he would do without tennis in a lot of ways. You know, I don't know what else would sort of take the place of that rush for him. And he clearly,
TikTok,
as much
Instagram,
as he doesn't love parts of it and really does. Yeah, I don't think that would really give him the kind of rush that he gets from playing on, you know, John Cain Arena or Rod Laver Arena here in front of thousands of people and putting on a show and beating the number ones in doubles with Kokkinakis. Like, this is, you know, he, even if he's conflicted by tennis, he still on some level loves it and is so good at it. And even if that is, you know, largely unrealized potential in a lot of ways, it's it's something that I think that he's going to really, you know, miss. And so I think he'll be around, but I think he, you know, maybe he can try to find a way to be a bit more part-time player to really reduce his schedule, you know, just affirmatively not play, you know, the European clay swing anymore ever again, which is not a part of the year he enjoys. You know, yeah, find things to manage it. But he did seem like, actually, he put in a pretty, from what he was, what we were seeing on social media at least, he put in a pretty solid offseason in terms of training and conditioning. And then obviously caught COVID right at the beginning of the season, which hurt his lead up considerably. But then he played pretty well against Medvedev in that four-set loss. And so it's very possible with a more favorable draw that he could have made some actual damage here.
I wouldn't be surprised if it went completely the opposite way. I think, and I've said this before on the program, I think Thanasi Kokkinakis and their friendship and their teammanship in the doubles is going to work for him. And I wouldn't be surprised if it just settled him down and gave him a genuine enjoyment on the world scene, traveling potentially with a team. He does seem to me to respond to teams, whether it be in the Laver Cup or the ATP Cup, Davis Cup. I don't think he really has much time for it at this stage. But I wouldn't be surprised if he went full circle and found a way to, you know, maximise his talents in another form, and that is part and parcel of the Thanasi team.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, honestly, I mean, he and Thanasi have the talent, have had some bad luck. Certainly Thanasi's had lots of bad luck with injury over the course of his career. And I would love to see them maximize on this opportunity they have in the doubles draw going forward. You know, when singles players are dedicated and motivated to do well in doubles, they do well. You know, these are guys who are frankly just more talented and bigger weapons than the doubles specialists who occupy most of that draw. And you saw that very clearly in their win over the top seeds and the gold medalists. So I would love to see them get to this. I just think it'd be just a nice, you know, sort of top line achievement, even if it's doubles, to have each of them be an Australian Open champion on some level would, I think, be reflective of their talents. And so I think that would be a well-deserved thing if they can, again, keep their focus and really commit to this thing, because certainly people won't roll over and give it to them in these last three rounds of the tournament.
So one thing that has certainly come to my attention is the doubles. Now, I used to be a great doubles lover. I used to watch the doubles. I used to love and admire the doubles teams and the tactics and the pairings. But it has gone right off the radar over the last decade or so. These two guys could actually put it back on the map and people start to take it more seriously. Certainly, the TV networks will be hoping that's the case.
Yeah, no, that's a huge, huge thing for doubles is relevance going forward is the top players playing it, the top single stars. Because doubles does not make stars, unfortunately, unless it's something really extreme like the Bryan brothers, you know, who are twins and have kind of gimmick and win double-digit slams together. But that's a really unique case. Otherwise, doubles does not, except unless, again, you're from a country that really doesn't have any other players. Like, there's been a few Indian double stars in the past couple decades, Sania Mirza, and then a couple on the men's side as well. But that's, again, a country with a big tennis appetite that hasn't had any singles traction at all.
Yeah, I've got to say,
those guys are making their moves.
I couldn't have told you the names of the doubles world champions. I just wouldn't have known them outside of the Bryan brothers. I think no one really has replaced this in our conscious mind.
No, completely. And so that's what I'm saying. The top singles players need to play doubles for it to stay relevant and, you know, honestly, to justify its continued existence on some level. And I think that there's it's tough, especially for the men. The best of five format at the Grand Slams is very prohibitive to adding on more things. And it's gotten much, much more physical and demanding. And, you know, there's so much more emphasis on recovery on off days between matches. And so just the top men are not doing it. But I've seen it, you know, in American tennis, certainly firsthand with the Williams sisters and women's doubles, how much it adds to the broadcasts and to the slate when, you know, you get a second chance to see these big stars often on, you know, closer up, smaller court in this different format. It really adds a tremendous amount of value for the tournaments when they can get the single stars on the court. So whatever can be done to do that, I think would really help make this a better used resource and opportunity.
And Ben, last one from me. Ash Barty, we know the form that she's been in. She's been world number one for what, best part of 2.5 years now. She's obviously a two-time champion, once at the French, once at the Wimbledon. Do you think that she needs to win her home slam to increase the aura over her? Do you think there are still people out there doubting whether she is the dominant world number one that others have been? I'm just interested in your view on that.
I would say, honestly, I think a few of those whispers or doubts were probably there before she won Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Because I think the way that she won the French Open, that draw really kind of collapsed around her. She didn't have to play a lot of established stars. The final was pretty lopsided. Honestly, she played against a player, Markéta Mondrosova, who just really had a kind of no-show effort that day. So it was not the most climactic Grand Slam win you'll ever see by any stretch. But then I think going forward then she held on to her ranking, and it was a bit in part because of the rankings freeze because of the pandemic that they changed the ranking. So even though she wasn't playing much during the early part of the pandemic when the tour resumed, it was still, you know, she still had that ranking. So that probably led to more questions as, you know, especially Osaka reeled off back-to-back Grand Slams with Barty was saying number one. But now I think really starting with her title in Miami actually last year, which was a pretty full-strength tournament that Barty won and played a bunch of big players and won it there. And then the Wimbledon title, I think that she's pretty clearly the number one and deservingly so. And obviously it'd be great for her perception in Australia. The title drought here has been longer than any other Grand Slam country in terms of not having a men's or women's singles champion from the home country. So for Australia, I'm sure it'd be huge and really kind of consolidate or consummate her stardom. But I think at this point, she's a consensus number one. There's no real plausible alternative to her.
And I thought last night we just saw her dissect a young up-and-comer, Amanda Anisimova.
Anisimova. Yep. Coached by an Australian in Dan Cahill.
And I'd like your thoughts on Anisimova. I'll get that name out.
Anisimova, yeah.
Anisimova.
Anisimova, yeah.
I was really fascinated by her win the previous a couple of nights ago against Naomi Osaka. Osaka, I thought, played a dumb game, just kept hitting it back to her strengths. And yet you saw a much more calculated game plan from Ash Barty, taking her off court, you know, using all manner of shots to basically just pick her out, unpick her at the seams, if you like. Your thoughts on how far the young American can go? Because she is young and she got a great lesson and she's got a great, now a great coach who knows all of what she needs to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. No, the talent's been there for Anisimova for quite a while at this point. And she was a junior U.S. Open champion at a very young age. I think she's 15 when she won that tournament. And she made the semifinals of that French Open, the Barty one, at 17, I believe. And so, and they played each other in a very sort of up and down rocky semifinal between the two that wound up being very fateful for Barty's career and trajectory. And then Anisimova's father passed away shortly after that, before the U.S. Open. And that really, you know, threw her career and its ascendancy for a real loop, and definitely derailed her in a bunch of ways, understandably, for a bit. But she's coming back from that now. She seems to have found a good base, like you said, and Darren Cahill signing up to work with her is a huge vote of confidence in her talent and her potential that a coach like Cahill would be signing on to the Anisimova team. She played well against Osaka. Osaka had match points in that match. It wasn't Osaka was, you know, out of it or thoroughly beaten. I mean, Osaka did come close, and that was the match everybody was circling in the draw when it came out. You know, this idea of a Barty-Osaka fourth round. So a bit of disappointment there. We didn't get to see that match because they've been the best two players for the last several years, but haven't barely played each other at all, with them playing fairly different schedules and peaking at different times. But Anisimova, I think, absolutely has the talent to become a top 10 player, let's say, this year. I think that she's very much someone to look out for, and someone who still has time and is growing to do, and her fitness can get better, I'm sure. But the raw weapons and the power things are there, because she really was, you know, trading power for power and winning against Osaka in that third round, which is not something that many players on this tour can do.
So will we ever see Federer and Venus and Serena Williams win another major?
Ooh, you know, it's honestly tough to say. I mean, honestly, I think the real question is if we'll see them back on tour.
Yeah.
You know, they're both in their, all three of them, if you mentioned Serena and Venus, they're in their 40s, all of them, and that's an age well past, you know, traditional sort of expiration dates for a tennis player's career. And Federer's had real, you know, significant knee injuries, and it's just, I think, sort of some of his rehab is just about trying to, you know, live a pain-free rest of his, you know, adult life, rather than trying to get back to the shape of being a, you know, elite competitive athlete, playing, you know, best five tennis matches in his 40s. So we'll see what he does, and same with the Williamses. You know, both their rankings will fall now well outside the top 200, I believe, after this tournament, because Serena made semifinals here last year. Which was an incredible run, and probably really underrated that she did that at 39, and, you know, played well enough to win that tournament really last year. So it's tough to say. I haven't seen, you know, they haven't confirmed anything. It's not clear how much Serena is planning on playing. She's playing a very partial schedule the last few years anyhow. So I don't know what she would target as a comeback if she even decides to come back. But yeah, it's been the sport will certainly miss them. But as we're seeing, and we saw at the U.S. Open last year, especially on the women's side maybe, where there was a really popular final with Emma Raducanu, the British teenager qualifier, came out of nowhere to win and become a real superstar of the sport. You know, the sport, like without Djokovic, will keep churning out new stars and new stories and have things for people to watch. And as great, as generationally great as people like Federer, the Williams sisters are, you know, the sport will find a way without them pretty organically.
And
there
it's done
still be
that
four Grand Slams a year and lots of chances for new champions. Yeah,
it's done that ever since Rod Laver retired. This Grand Slam winner, proper Grand Slam winner, and the sport has continued to be healthy. Great to have you on board, Ben.
Thanks,
really
Ben.
Appreciate your time and your thoughts, and giving you so much of your time. All the best.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Ben Rothenberg, the man when it comes to global tennis, and you can see why with how eloquently he speaks. He's got really good relationships with players, Jared, and he doesn't shy away from criticising people when he needs to, which I think is the mark of a great journalist. More sports day after this.